The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hey, good afternoon. I am Georgene Rice, in for Frank Sontag. I'm the afternoon talk host at KKLA's sister station, KPDQ, in Portland. That's Oregon. Well, Frank begins each hour with an impact statement. That's about 20-plus minutes of uninterrupted dialogue and discussion. So let's get started with a look at the day's top news stories. And these days, there's no lack for top news stories. Well, a new map highlighting the spread of the coronavirus shows more than half of all states trending poorly or facing an uncontrolled spread. Those are in quotes. As COVID-19 continues to make a resurgence all across the country, created by COVIDExitStrategy.org, the map, it tracks every state's coronavirus response based on the set of criteria provided by the White House that specifies what each state and each region has to accomplish before moving forward with plans to reopen their economies. Now, both in the state of California and in Oregon, where I am seated today, we've seen the reopening restricted, pulled back somewhat. Well, the map measures and scores each state based on the number of positive cases over a 14-day period. It uses a 7-day rolling average, bed capacity at hospitals, intensive care units, and positivity rates. Well, according to that figure, New York once again is the epicenter of the virus. It's trending for the better, while the nearly all of southern and other Midwestern states are faring far worse. California is listed with an uncontrolled spread, 219 cases per every million people. Meanwhile, Texas, Florida, and Georgia, they're also seeing giant upticks in COVID-19 cases. Tomorrow, we're going to talk with Dr. Pham on how do you attribute the increase in cases of COVID-19 in the state of California. He's going to try to unpack that for us somewhat. The governor there, he's ordered the closure of indoor activities across the state, as you know, and in Lauderdale, Florida, the homeless, they've been put up in motels. Experts are warning that COVID-19 herd immunity is wishful thinking. There's a Hong Kong virologist. She's claiming that coronavirus, there's a cover-up. She says she wants to expose that. We don't have much time, she says. The Chinese government says we don't know who this person is, but it's not surprising that they wouldn't publicly acknowledge her. So that's continuing. We'll maybe talk more about that later in the hour. And while the influence of political endorsements is always debatable, there's little argument that President Trump's backing in a Republican primary can make a pretty big difference. While his record's not perfect, three Trump-endorsed House candidates lost primaries in recent weeks. The president's support is extremely influential, especially in potential low-turnout contests, such as in Tuesday's Senate runoff in Alabama and two House district runoffs in Texas. In Alabama, former U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is fighting for his political life as he fights off the ire of President Trump. Sessions, who served a dozen years as a senator from Alabama before becoming Trump's first attorney general in 2017, he angered the president by recusing himself that year from the Russia investigation into the 2016 election. I probably didn't even need to say it. It was so often repeated by the president. Well, his rival in this election, first-time politician and former Auburn University football coach Tommy Tuberville, enjoys the president's backing. Other related developments, Sessions insists that Trump is good for America after the president has attacked him as a disaster on Twitter. A longtime Republican operative Roger Stone publicly thanked the president for commuting his impending jail sentence on Monday, saying the president had shown enormous courage. This is the most horrible experience you can have because I see immediately why 99% of people who choose to plead not guilty and go to trial lose when you're up against the horrific and deep-pocketed resources of the federal government and these really sadistic, arrogant, politically motivated prosecutors, Stone told Hannity in his first televised interview since his commutation was announced on Friday. I had a biased judge, he went on to say. I had a stacked jury. I had a corrupt jury forewoman. My trial was over before it started. Well, Missouri, there's a man there who guarded his home with a rifle, and he reveals that there are rumors that he and his wife will be indicted for attempting to defend their home. And the editor of the Washington Post says that Texas Rangers, the name, that must go. Now, most people have no idea what the history of the Texas Rangers might be and why anyone would object, but in these cancel culture days, you don't have to know. You just have to nod your head and say, okay. The Supreme Court has cleared the way for the execution of a federal prisoner. That happened earlier in the day. And Iran's nuclear facilities are mysteriously under attack. I wonder who's responsible for that. Meanwhile, the White House is urging the jobless to find something new in an ad campaign. Find something new. The Deutsche Bank executives are responsible for Epstein's relationship. They've been named in the New York Times. What will be the fallout? Not yet clear. Well, as we discussed briefly yesterday, the governor of California, a Democrat, announced during a press briefing that all bars across the state must close up shop, and that restaurants, wineries, tasting rooms, family entertainment centers, zoos, museums, and card rooms must suspend indoor activities. L.A., which lost control of the pandemic numbers, followed the massive protests and riots, is moving into what they're calling the red zone COVID-19 threat, the highest, according to Mayor Eric Garcetti. Small businesses are barely afloat, and many are devastated. PragerU points out, never forget, this protest was allowed in California. No masks or social distancing was required. However, salons, restaurants, retail stores, bars, and many businesses will be forced into bankruptcy. Churches are being forced to close. The left is weaponizing COVID-19, end quote. The daily death count remains exceptionally low nationwide, despite all of the headlines. Meanwhile, Democratic mayor of Atlanta, where riots and protests help propel higher numbers there, is shocked. Shocked, I say, the Republican governor isn't panicking and shutting down the state. Another look at why schools should reopen. That's what we'll talk about later in this hour. John Fund is looking at the prediction track of track record, rather, of Dr. Fauci, which is rather interesting. You can find out more in National Review. But as one might expect in the circumstances of an unpredictable pandemic, it's not altogether surprising that, well, he's not quite as reliable as some might hope. Well, the Amazon is using the name of book on troubling trans activism to sell pro-trans propaganda from the author Abigail Schreier. She says Amazon has sold the title of my book as a key for ads and other books, one celebrating gender transition for teens. So even if you enter the whole title into at Amazon, Amazon will try to get you to read something else. Wow, you might want to do your own homework these days. Well, a Princeton professor has been harassed for questioning woke students' demands. Just raising the question, challenging. Can you explain to me? That's not permitted, particularly if you're a professor at Princeton. Among the demands he questioned, giving black professors perks not available to white professors. Doesn't matter if you're a good professor or a bad professor, if you teach well, if you're credentialed, all you have to do is have a little pigment and you get some special perks. Wow, as an African-American woman, I find that rather offensive. But then again, that's just me. Let's see. Los Angeles County's black DA has blasted Black Lives Matter for targeting her, showing up at her home, and speaking out against abolishing police. Again, she didn't get the memo. You do not question these movements. You simply follow in lockstep. I mean, we need to send the paperwork out again, apparently, because some of us just don't get it. Or is it that some of us are just thinking more deeply about these issues? Wisconsin's vote by mail may have looked bad, but it was actually worse than originally thought. Meanwhile, California rejected 100,000 mail-in ballots because of mistakes. And a judge has given a green light to the Trump book by his notoriety-seeking niece, Mary Trump. Now, I don't want to be there at Christmas or Thanksgiving around that table as they're discussing book sales and some of the specific content of the book. In the latest of COVID-19, the World Health Organization that suppresses early information is now sounding the alarm as coronavirus cases rise by 1 million in 5 days. The CDC's best estimate is that about 40% of infections are asymptomatic. So you may have it, have no idea. Dr. Anthony Fauci says the U.S. coronavirus cases are surging because the nation didn't totally shut down. Can you imagine if we had totally shut down. That means healthcare workers, everybody. Meanwhile, Asia is ramping up their coronavirus curbs as new clusters erupt there. Well, in Los Angeles and San Diego, they will not reopen classrooms in the fall. We'll talk more about how you would go about it when we speak with Rachel Gressler with the Heritage Foundation and her associate. We'll talk with Dr. Lindsay Burke. She's the director of the Center for Education Policy on some key recommendations on how to go about reopening schools if they ever open again. And the Orange County Board of Education has voted to support the return to school without social distancing and masks. Now, if you want to learn more about that, the Orange County Register goes into some detail. Well, banks stand to make about $18 billion in PPP processing fees. The government has made loans available to try to keep folks afloat. $18 billion, that's what banks stand to make. The NBA has banned custom jerseys with Free Hong Kong, but they were allowing burn Jews and kill cops. Well, they have since reversed themselves, saying, well, we never intended to allow these other two offensive monikers, but you can now get the Free Hong Kong. But that was a reversal. And in fact, it was probably a setup to try to determine or to expose just how much the NBA relies on the People's Republic of China and goes out of its way not to criticize the country. Local governments are weighing major tax hikes. They're trying to plug coronavirus-induced shortfalls. So keep your eyes and ears open and your wallet close at hand. Meanwhile, record numbers of Americans are trying to buy guns for reasons I don't think need much explanation. At least 17 people were shot in New York City on Monday as lawlessness soars there. A Washington State police officer has been killed, another injured by an assailant, and the violence right here in my home city of Portland, Oregon, has continued. In fact, the police are now required to refer to what's going on in these protests that have continued from the day of the death of George Floyd to the present and will continue in the days following. Are required to declare it a riot before they're permitted to actually resist what's happening, the destruction of property and so on. Meanwhile, the UK has reneged. They are purging their relationship with Huawei as from 5G by 2027. I mean, a lot of damage can be done between now and 2027, but at least they've seen the light apparently far off into the distance. Move toward the light and, you know, accelerate your divorce with Huawei. China has begun mass production of a new stealth fighter jet in an effort to dominate airspace, and Iran's nuclear facilities are mysteriously under attack. Well, for the first time ever, the United States has officially rejected China's unlawful South China Sea claims. We'll see where that goes. And the fathers of communism were racist. I'm so surprised. We have so many Marxists running around today, some under the moniker, not all, but some under the moniker of Black Lives Matter. And yet they haven't yet denounced the founding fathers of communism. Something to look for. Now, I love history, and it's always interesting to me when I look back at events that were all of the nation's attention, all of the world's attention is focused on a particular thing, and now they're just faint memories. It helps me get some perspective on big news stories of our day that seem overwhelming. Can we survive them? So this day in history, 1789, in an event symbolizing the start of the French Revolution, citizens of Paris stormed the Bastille prison and released the seven prisoners inside. We're experiencing something of a similar set of events. We haven't quite stormed the Bastille prison, but we're seeing similar events from the French Revolution. If time permits today, we're going to talk about the difference between what happened in the French Revolution in 1789 and what happened here in 1776. On this day in history, 1798, Congress passes the Sedition Act, making it a federal crime to publish false, scandalous, or malicious writing about the United States government. Well, if that were the case today, if we were to impose that that law today, much of mainstream media would be out of work, as well as many politicians. 1976, Jimmy Carter wins the Democratic presidential nomination at the party's convention in New York. 1980, the Republican National Convention opens in Detroit, where presumptive nominee Ronald Reagan tells a welcoming rally he and his supporters are determined to, you guessed it, make America great again. 2003, newspaper columnist Robert Novak publicly reveals the CIA employment of Valerie Plame, wife of Joseph Wilson, a former U.S. ambassador in Africa who said the administration had twisted pre-war intelligence of Iraq. Remember how much time, attention, and resource went to investigating that. And finally, in 2013, on this very day in history, thousands of demonstrators across the country protest a Florida jury decision to clear George Zimmerman and the shooting death of Trayvon Martin. As I mentioned, here in the Pacific Northwest, violence has continued. One police officer was killed. Another was injured in a shooting in downtown Bothell. That's in Washington on Monday night. After a traffic stop turned into a brief car chase, the chase began with Bothell police responding to a traffic stop about 9:40 p.m. last night. The Everett police spokesperson said, who answered questions about all of this, the driver led police on a short car chase before he got out, started running. Assisting police arrived to find the two officers injured. One was taken to the hospital and died. The other was able to survive his injuries and later was released from the hospital. And meanwhile, here in the People's Republic of Portland, the protests was declared a riot in North Portland after demonstrator and police faced off. Now, this is a regular daily occurrence here, literally a daily occurrence. There have been protests, demonstrations of various sorts, many of which have ended in violence and the destruction of public and private property since the day of George Floyd's death. In fact, I live in a regular neighborhood. I don't live in a busy thoroughfare. I'm in the heart of the city. I live in a residential street, a quiet street. Now, the bus line does run down this street, but we have had on several occasions thousands of protesters marching in front of my home. Now, from the distance, you could hear the din, Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter. Now, I have to tell you, I had mixed feelings as an African-American woman. The history of my family flashed through my my head. I thought about how profoundly racism has impacted my family from its very beginning. I am the descendant of slaves. But I was also reminded of the Christian faith that guided my parents through seasons of Jim Crow and discrimination here in the Pacific Northwest that rivals that in the South. And how as a young woman, actually as a kid, very, very young woman, as a kid, it was the way my parents responded to racism as I was growing up that led me to the conclusion that I did not have within myself the capacity to respond in the way that they did apart from Christ. I saw the Holy Spirit work in them to respond in a way that was not a natural inclination. It wasn't the natural way to respond to hatred. And it was watching them as a youngster that led me at about 5 or 6 years old to say, Lord, I need you. I want to respond. I want to have the kind of character I see in my parents so I can respond to people who wrong me in the same way that I see my parents respond to people who wrong them. So all of this is running through my head as I hear the faint cry of Black Lives Matter. It brought tears to my eyes. In fact, my mother, who's 89, she lives with my husband and me in our home. I brought her out to the window so that she could see these thousands and literally thousands and thousands of people marching in front of our home. It took 30 minutes or more for them to pass. So she could hear this cry of Black Lives Matter. And it was really quite moving. On the other hand, I'm thinking now, are these the peaceful protesters who actually have a legitimate point that all of us agree to in that brief moment following the death of George Floyd, when we saw that video and we saw what happened to him, and practically everyone came to the conclusion that this is unacceptable, something must be done. Well, that was very faint because the message was immediately overtaken by other forces who had very little interest in George Floyd. They didn't listen to what the Floyd family had to say about how they wanted protests and demonstrations to be conducted. They had no interest in the kind of man that George Floyd was trying to be, a man of peace, a family of peace. They had no interest in that. The only concern was we are going to exploit this situation for our own ends, and we're going to get out of it everything we intend to produce revolution. So I'm also thinking, as I'm hearing this faint cry, which became louder and louder, Black Lives Matter. Now, is this the reflection of the movement that has a genuine interest in the injustice that we see in our country, or are they going to come and break the windows of our car and our home? So all of this is racing through my head altogether. So we've had riots and protests in Portland every day since George Floyd's death in May. So the police have to declare a riot before they're in a position to respond. There have been federal there has been a federal presence most recently, and there's some back and forth over whether or not our leaders here like the way the federals are responding to all of this. But this is no new thing here. At least 24 police officers in riot gear surrounded the building near the area where this was taking place, and it went on for quite some time. So here in the Pacific Northwest, things are continuing to heat up, and I fully expect, because we've had events in front of our home, I think 4 occasions, that would occur at any point, at any time. In fact, if you hear something in the background, I'll just let you know. Maybe we're having a demonstration out in front of my home. So that's what's happening here in the Pacific Northwest. I pray for truth and justice. I pray that the Christian community would rise and speak clearly and with grace to the issues of our day. And I want to be among them. So that's kind of where we stand right now. Now, I should mention that coming up in our next segment, we're going to talk with Rachel Gresler. She's going to talk about school closures and what the Pediatric Association has said about what's worse for kids, staying home or going to school in the midst of a pandemic. All of that when we return to the Frank Sontag Show.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Georgene Rice, in for Frank Sontag. I'm the afternoon talk host at KKLA's sister station, KPDQ in Portland, and delighted to fill some considerably large shoes for the next couple of days. Well, we've been thinking a lot about education these days, given the fact that schools, for the most part, are closed, and we have different formulas for how schools should open. Well, recently, the American Academy of Pediatrics weighed in with a new report that advocates opening the schools while providing some age-based safety guidelines. Well, here to tell us more about that and how that might inform our decision-making is Rachel Gresler with the Heritage Foundation. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Georgine. Thank you for having me.
Well, as you probably know, Los Angeles and San Diego have decided they are not going to reopen schools, at least not immediately, and there's a lot of back and forth as to what's in the best interest of students and their guardians, both their parents and their teachers. What has the American Academy of Pediatrics offered to help us sort through all of the variables to determine what's in the best interest of students and their caretakers?
Yes, and so the American Academy of Pediatrics came out with this report, and they really took a holistic view of children's health and well-being, not just looking at COVID-19 only, but their education, their physical and mental well-being also. And the result is that it's not even a close call. You know, the risks and the detriment to children of not opening schools in person far outweigh the risks of COVID-19. The Academy's report stated in boldface, "The APP strongly advocates that all policy considerations for the coming school year should start with the goal of having students physically present in school." And I know that from my own experience, having it will be 5 children in the fall in elementary and middle school, that kids just do not learn the same way online as they do in person. It's like having to peek through a keyhole in a door. You can catch a little bit of what's going on, but you're never going to have that same experience if you were actually in the room. And so, you know, education is just one component of it. There's also the disparate impact across income groups and different races. And then there's also the sad reality of children who are at risk and who are going to be subject to increased neglect and abuse because schools are not open in person.
Now, balancing what the AAP has recommended with the concerns over COVID-19, perhaps less children contracting it and suffering gravely as a consequence than them having an impact on their teachers, parents, or grandparents. How do you balance all of those variables so that we put children and their interests first while at the same time recognizing all of the other attendant concerns?
Right. And so there's a way to do this responsibly and safely. And both the science and the experience that has already happened so far in a lot of European countries that have reopened schools and child care centers, we can learn a lot from them. You know, in the U.S., children represent about 22% of the population, but less than 2% of all COVID-19 cases. Children are less likely to spread the virus if they do contract it. They're very unlikely to have severe symptoms. The death rate is statistically zero among children. You know, you look at studies in Australia, and there was one where they had a total of 9 students and 9 teachers that they determined had COVID-19. Those 18 individuals were in contact with 863 different people, and yet all they found was 2 cases, and they were students who never actually exhibited symptoms, but just were, you know, found positive antibody tests afterwards, so they didn't even know if they had necessarily contacted the virus in the school systems. And so acknowledging that even when kids do contract the virus, they're less likely to pass it on to adults, and so the teachers are more likely to be getting the virus from other adults that they're in contact with than they are with the children. Nonetheless, you know, we need to take precautions and things like masks and greater distance, maybe having the teacher teach, you know, not rotating the children between classrooms, things like this all make sense. But there are common sense ways to do it instead of just keeping kids out of the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Your article that appeared in the Daily Signal, you point out that at-risk adults can take measures to mitigate their risks of COVID-19, but children are largely helpless against the harms caused by school closures, and these harms are threefold. Now, you've touched on them, but let's for the sake of understanding, let's repeat. The first is there's the education loss. It's not exclusively that, but there are other things as well. Talk about these threefold losses that children experience when they are not given access to in-school education.
Certainly. And so, you know, education, of course, is first and foremost because that's the purpose of children going to school. We already saw that in the spring, almost half of students that were in 28 states that didn't actually mandate distance learning. So some of those individuals had nothing. And we heard disproportionately from Hispanics and African-American families that they received nothing from their schools about instruction. And so you just have that complete loss of learning. And there was a McKinsey study. They actually modeled the impact of 3 different scenarios playing out for the fall. One is everybody just goes back to school as they normally would have. 2 is that it's only partial in school, partial online until January of next year, and the other that they wouldn't go back until the following school year. And just looking at the difference between going back in person in the fall as we normally would versus waiting until 2021 to be fully back, which is what a lot of school districts, my own children's included, have decided to do, they found that even people who are getting an average online education would lose 3 to 4 months of learning. So over 3 months of school, you're going to lose 3 to 4 months of learning. But it went on to point out that other children who will get below average learning access will lose 7 to 11 months. And others with really poor quality instruction will lose 12 to 14 months. And then some people will drop out entirely, you know, especially at the high school level, and just never come back. So this is really troubling, especially when you consider the already disparate impact that exists in education between white students and Black and Hispanic ones. And that's the second point here, is that this is just going to exacerbate existing gaps in education that we already see. And that's what surveys from parents show, you know, their experience already with online learning. The lower-income families are 5 times more likely to report receiving no distance learning at all, twice as likely to report that it's going poorly. You know, an overwhelming majority of African-American and Hispanic families say that they're concerned that they don't have the resources to keep their children on track. And then getting on to the third point here, which really is just heartbreaking to me, is the issue of abuse and neglect. The school shutdowns mean that vulnerable children who are in abusive home environments are going to be spending more time in the situations where the most neglect and abuse occurs, at a time when economic and health stresses have contributed to more abuse and neglect. And then they're not going to come into contact with the teachers and other professionals who are the ones that report the majority of abuse. You know, in 2018 alone, there were 3.5 million children who came into contact with Child Protective Services. 678,000 of them were determined to be victims of maltreatment. And so you just have this situation now where it's really created a perfect storm for more neglect and abuse occurs and for it to go unreported. So I think that recognizing that schools are an important component for these vulnerable children is another reason to get them back into the classroom.
Well, again, I would encourage our listeners to read the American Academy of Pediatrics report that outlines these issues in some detail, and I appreciate your joining us today to draw our attention to some of the reasons that reopening schools is an important consideration beyond education, but certainly for education reasons as well. Rachel Gressler, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Georgine Rice in for Frank Sontag. We're going to take a quick break. We will be back to talk with Dr. Lindsay Burke. How do we reopen schools when, in fact, that time comes? We'll be back in just a few moments.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Well, good afternoon and welcome back to the Frank Sontag Show. I'm Georgine Rice, in for Frank Sontag. I'm the afternoon host at KKLA's sister station, KPDQ, in Portland. We're excited to have you with us. We're talking about education. As you probably know by now, Los Angeles and San Diego will not reopen classrooms in the fall. Now, this is contrary to the advice the president is offering, saying kids must get back into the classroom. And there's lots of back and forth over whether or not that's the case. And if children are to return to the classroom, how do you do that? Well, here to talk with us about that is Dr. Lindsay Burke. She is the director of the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation, and they've offered some key recommendations for reopening the K through 12 classroom. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Burke.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, this is really a contentious issue, but there have been some who've had their heads down and are working on when the time comes, how to return children to the classroom safely. And these recommendations are the result of that kind of effort. Can you explain these recommendations and the source from which they've come?
Well, the recommendations come from the National Coronavirus Recovery Commission, which is an effort that Heritage launched in conjunction with experts across the country in a wide range of issues. And we looked closely at this question of school reopening in particular and have quite a few recommendations that touch on that. On the health side, really school leaders should review all aspects of their school facilities and their operations and really look for ways to prevent transmission when they do open. And schools should open. They should do so, and they should do so safely. But state and local governments should also allow K-12 schools to open, and then if there is an issue, to selectively quarantine any students or faculty or staff who show symptoms. And so this is different than saying an entire state should shut down their schools, but if there is an issue, to go school by school and to really look at the conditions on the ground. And so those are really, I think, broadly the recommendations in terms of school reopening, looking at that local data and then making a decision that way. And then if schools are not going to reopen, and you mentioned Los Angeles, which is a really good, bad example of that, parents should be able to take their money elsewhere.
Now, is there a federal role in this decision-making process? The president is imposing the notion that kids must return to schools. Some of the local communities and states are certainly not embracing that idea. Is there a role for the federal government in all of this in determining the timing and the resources available to make it safe for not only children but for their teachers?
So to some extent, and it comes down to that word resources that you said a second ago, the federal government should certainly use that bully pulpit. The administration is right to call on schools to reopen as quickly and safely as possible. But beyond that, it really needs to be a locally driven decision. It needs to be a state-driven decision working in conjunction with parents and local leaders. On that resources question, though, this is where the federal government can play a role. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos over the weekend made a really important and, I think, smart policy call. She said over the weekend that if schools are not going to reopen, that those dollars that are currently spent at the federal level should follow students to schools of choice that are actually open. Right now, we are sending money to schools. The doors are closed. Parents cannot access these schools. So those dollars should follow children to schools that are open, that are the right fit for them. And I think that's the right response, that, you know, it's not about the amount or whether or not we cut off funding or don't, but allowing families to really determine how those dollars are spent.
One of the recommendations in there, as I mentioned, are 10 of them, but is that states with online schools lift any barriers to access, including caps, enrollment restrictions, or grade prohibitions for students in grades K through 12. We know that in some cases there has been real pushback among public educators allowing students to transfer to charter schools where there is the opportunity, or online schools, there is the opportunity for education. Can you elaborate on that?
Which is just, it's really incredible at this moment in time that we would see special interest groups try to block access to both charter schools and online learning options and online charter school options. I mean, you cannot fathom a worse moment in time for these special interest groups to try to prevent students from having access to some of the only options that are open on the ground right now. And so that's been really disappointing to see. One of our recommendations is that every student should have equal access to online education, regardless of zip code, regardless of their district boundary, and should be able to access those online options now during the pandemic and then in the future if that's the right fit for them. This is something, if we go state by state and think about what state-level policy reforms need to change to really rise to the occasion in which we find ourselves, providing families with emergency education savings accounts, I think, is one really smart, targeted way to get there. And again, this really comes down to families having access over the dollars that are currently spent at the state level on their child, but those children can't access the public schools that their taxpayers are paying for. So fund the child instead, and I would argue this is good policy anytime, that we should fund students and not centers or institutions, and allow those dollars to follow kids to any education provider of choice, be it online, in school, hybrid, or whatever it is that meets their needs.
How optimistic are you that the kinds of decision-making that this report suggests are going to be applied? For example, where you have state and local authorities making decisions on which schools open based on the numbers on the ground, and that it would vary from one community to another, one district to another, based on what's happening there specifically, or that there would be a portability to the resources that parents and educators have access to for students who don't have the opportunity to return to a classroom, who might benefit from some other form of teaching or transferring to another location where there is in-school training?
Well, it will vary widely the extent to which local schools are really looking at the data, using that to make a decision about reopening, just as it varies considerably in how they're thinking broadly about what school looks like in the fall, what it looks like when students come back. Will it be hybrid or online, or will it be fully in person? Will schools have in place emergency management plans, which they should absolutely think about doing in the event that something like this happens in the future? Or maybe it's not something like a pandemic, but some other external factor that causes them to close their schools. We're also at the point now where we're getting more and more data every hour of every day from around the world. What are other countries doing when it comes to school reopening? And so there are lessons there that we can take as well that are at least instructive. We know generally now that the data suggests that it is rare for children to develop severe symptoms if they contract the virus. It's rare for them to spread it if they do get it. And so part of that explains why we are seeing so many countries around the world start to reopen their schools. Some never closed schools. Sweden never shut down their schools during the pandemic. But now if we look around the world, we see in Denmark, for instance, Denmark was the first country in Europe to reopen its schools. They reopened all the way back on April 15th. They've restructured schools to try to have kids spend as much class time as possible outside. So that is one approach that some countries are taking. Other places are grouping students in what have been deemed pods, so small groups of about 12 students that they stick with throughout the day. Finland reopened schools in May. France has reopened their schools, and the list goes on and on. Germany has reopened schools on a part-time basis, and as I said, some have been open since the beginning of the pandemic. So there are lessons that we can learn from around the world. Japan reopened its schools in June, and parents there take their children's temperature every morning before children report to school for the day. They attend school on alternating days. So there are places we can look to get some clues for how this ultimately might unfold here.
I know one of the concerns is that while students may not contract the virus and carry that in a very serious way for themselves, but they may infect others around them. The concern is the teachers, parents, grandparents who may come in contact with those students. Is there any data to indicate the likelihood that while students may not suffer from COVID-19, others around them might?
Right. So a report that came out in Science magazine, which is a very well-respected journal, they said in that journal that students and children, it was rare for them to spread the virus if they do, in fact, get it. There was also a study that came out of France about a month ago that found that when students did contract it, it appeared that they were contracting it within the community and at home rather than in their school setting. So I think that's some important context for us as well. So again, you know, we've got some data from around the world that we should really incorporate as we're starting to think about what it might look like here. It is, I think, a really important question and certainly an important conversation for folks mm-hmm. around the country to have about teachers. You know, how do we think about teachers, the role that they play, how this fits into this question about reopening schools? Yes, it is true that teachers on average, of course, are older than their student population, but on average, most teachers are in their 40s. And so that's something I think should be considered moving forward as well, that, you know, we might face a scenario where some teachers want to continue doing an online option or want to continue a hybrid option moving forward. And so I think it's just the bottom line is we need to be really flexible overall about how we think about delivering education, how we think about access to content, and how we think about both the student and teacher perspective in these reopening decisions.
Absolutely. Dr. Lindsay Burke, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Burke is the director of the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation, and the 10 recommendations for reopening K through 12 is part of a larger survey the National Coronavirus Recovery Commission recently released. It is comprehensive. It offers 264 recommendations to guide America through this pandemic. That includes how to reopen schools safely in various places across the country. You're listening to the Frank Sontag Show. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back with Hour 2.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, good afternoon and welcome back. I am Georgine Rice, in for Frank Sontag. I'm the afternoon talk host at KKLA sister station, KPDQ in Portland, Oregon. For those of you listening in Los Angeles on 99.5 KKLA, thanks for joining us. I know Frank begins every hour with an impact statement, 20 plus minutes of uninterrupted dialogue and discussion. We'll get to that in just a few moments with my guest, Senior Judge Tom Cole and founder of Paid in Full. A couple of breaking news stories I wanted to mention. Ruth Bader Ginsburg apparently was admitted today to hospital for treatment of a possible infection, according to the Supreme Court. They say that she was admitted in Baltimore today for treatment of the infection. We don't have any other details, how long she's expected to stay and so on. But with the precarious nature of the Supreme Court, lots of people are speculating whether or not she will ultimately provide a vacancy or someone might retire before the election. And we know what happened the last administration when there was a vacancy during an election year. Let's hope that's not a topic of discussion anytime soon. Also, the Trump administration announced that they are going to rescind the rule on foreign students amid pressure from colleges. The administration said today that it is withdrawing the proposed rule that would have forced foreign students to return home if college courses they were enrolled in were to be held entirely online when colleges reopen in the fall. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, announced last week that those on F1 or M1 student visas would need to leave the U.S. or transfer to another college if their school offered classes entirely online when they reopen in the fall. If they do not, or in this case did not, they could face deportation proceedings. Again, the Trump administration has rescinded that rule on foreign students amid pressure from colleges. So I wanted to let you know that. Well, my next guest is Senior Judge Tom Cole. He's been a State of Oregon Circuit Court judge for over 20 years. He was president of the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association, founder and presiding judge for Washington County Adult Drug Court. He's an author, public speaker, and the founder and director of Paid in Full. Back in 2006, he lost his daughter, Megan. She was brutally murdered. Judge Cole wrote a book about that and his experience in drug court. As a result, he was invited to speak in prisons all across the country, which led to the founding of Paid in Full, which has placed a fully accredited college program in the Oregon State prison system. He's retired from full-time judging and currently is on assignment part-time as a senior judge for the state of Oregon. And I'm just delighted to welcome Judge Cole to this program. Good afternoon, Judge Cole. Okay, apparently we have lost him. I'm sure we'll find him again. Let me do what I need to do for my end, and maybe we can call him back. Hopefully we'll have him back on the line here shortly. All right. Taking a look at some of the other developments of the day, one-third of all practicing Christians haven't been watching either their own church online or other church streaming worship services since the state lockdowns in response to the coronavirus. We're going to talk later in the hour about what that means. Christians aren't fellowshipping through technology. Now, there are a number of explanations. Maybe the technology simply isn't available, but there may be other reasons as well. Barna recently did a study on it. We're going to talk about the implications of it and how this pandemic is impacting your faith. Now, I think we have Judge Cole back with us. Judge Tom Cole, are you with us?
I am.
Okay. Welcome. It's a delight to have you with us today. Now, I was telling our listeners a bit of your odyssey. You are currently in ministry, but you took a rather circuitous route to get there. Let's start with the beginning of your career and the role that you played in drug court here in the state of Oregon.
Yeah. Thanks, Georgine. Thanks for having me on your show again.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. I started out as a judge back in 1997. I was a lawyer for a few years before that. And in the early part of 2005, my heart was just pulled towards Drug Court, which is a national organization, and they have drug courts all over the country. And the purpose of Drug Court is rather than to send people to prison, it's to treat them in the system while they're in the system. It's for drug addicts and generally property offenders. To get in drug court, they needed to plead guilty to the crimes they were charged with. And then they were ordered to participate in our drug court program in Washington County here in Oregon.
As you're in your role as a judge, you came in contact with a lot of people who were struggling, and you never imagined that your work in that capacity would have such a personal impact until you lost your daughter.
Yeah. So when I first started judging, I was pretty harsh, and a lot of lawyers didn't want to appear in front of me because people who were committing crimes and doing drugs, I just had no empathy for them at all, and I was fairly harsh with them. As I went on, my daughter, I found out, was starting to use drugs, and so she started out with alcohol and then marijuana, and she gradually went to methamphetamine, and methamphetamine is an awful, awful drug. So my heart started to change towards people then, and so that's when we took a look in Washington County at starting our first drug court. And so that was a huge awakening period for me to see that drug courts actually work. They can take an individual instead of treating them harshly. We treat them, in the court system. And we were very, very successful. We had national recognition on that, on our drug court. And so it was just a really very, very a blessing to the system, a blessing to me. The participants, their lives were changed. They were transformed. And they would generally stay in the program anywhere from 18 months to 2 years. We would have a graduation when they finally did all the things they were supposed to do. The charges were dismissed. And they went on with their lives. Those who didn't complete drug court were he gave them a lot of chances. It was a court of second, third, and fourth chances. And eventually, if they didn't do what they were supposed to do, they ended up going to prison. Most of them. So the ones that failed.
So you learned that your daughter had been taking drugs, but then her life is taken from her. How did that impact your practice as a judge and awaken you to what would later become a ministry?
Yeah, that's a parent's worst nightmare when you find out, you've lost a child. And I knew she was hanging around with some really, really bad people, and she was doing, her judgment was completely lost with the drugs that she was taking. And so on July 21st of 2006, I had a knock on the door, and a couple of police officers and a DA came into my home. They had me sit down, and they told me that awful news that Megan had been murdered earlier in the day. And, that began the parents' worst nightmare for me.
Yes.
It was very, very difficult. I was very fortunate to be able to turn to God in that situation, not turn away from Him, because He got me through that entire process, the first year, the grieving process, and of course, having to deal with the ultimate arrest of the man who murdered my daughter and the trial that ensued shortly after that.
You've lost your daughter, which, as you've pointed out, is the parent's worst nightmare. The person who's responsible for her death has now been identified and is eventually incarcerated. You chose to communicate with that individual, and this is a significant part of your story. Talk a little bit about your mindset in communicating with the person you knew ended the life of your daughter.
Yeah, it was one of those things where I was in so much grief. I had so much sorrow, so much despair. There wasn't any room for any hatred or anger towards the person who had murdered my daughter. They didn't find out who it was until about a year later. That's when they charged the individual. So, so in that whole process, the idea of forgiveness was just implanted in my heart by Jesus. I mean, it was truly amazing that there was, all of a sudden, I'm seeing this man, I'm seeing him on TV, I'm hearing about him, and this idea of wanting to, communicate with him and tell him the good news of the gospel started to just sort of materialize in my heart. The trial occurred in February of 2009, and I was asked to testify at the sentencing phase of that trial. So I was able to go and testify in front of the jury and in front of the man's first name is Robert. And I was able to tell him that I had forgiven him before I even knew who he was. Only through the power and presence of Jesus Christ in my life was I able to do that. And so as I was testifying, I was crying. Some members of the jury were crying. And I stepped off the witness stand, walked by him, and looked at him. So the jury ended up, the jury has the power to choose death or life in an aggravated murder case, which this was. And so the jury chose life in prison without the possibility of parole. And that's what he was sentenced to. Shortly after that, I felt that God was asking me to write a book about Megan, about the idea of forgiveness, about the idea of hope and comfort. So I started writing that book, and it was 4 years to the day of her anniversary of her death on July 21st of 2010 that I began to write the book.
It's such an interesting convergence. You are a judge. Your daughter is murdered by someone, and I know drugs played a role in all of that. You declared that you, through the power of the Holy Spirit in your life and in your heart, were able to forgive that person before you knew his name or saw his face. God was doing a deep work in your life. It's interesting to consider that God used the convergence of all of these events to propel you into ministry. I'm sure that's the last thing that you imagine would be the result of all of this. The work that you had done as a lawyer, the work that you have done sitting on the bench as a judge, seeing the loss of your daughter and the person responsible for that. It's enough to imagine a person survives all of that with their faith intact, but God was calling you to do more. Tell us a little bit about how he called you out into what would ultimately be ministry.
Yeah. So I never thought it's one of those. I think it's a perfect example of Romans 8:28. You know, where Scripture goes. You know, God turns all things into good for those who love Him, for those who are called according to His purpose. And I never thought that God could turn the murder of my daughter into something good. I mean, you never expect something like that. But so as I was writing the book, and the book is called Losing Megan, Finding Hope, Comfort, and Forgiveness in the Midst of Murder. It's on Amazon. But as I was writing that book, I thought I had finished the book. And then God kind of put it on my heart. No, He wanted me to write one more chapter. He wanted me to go visit Robert in prison. And so I ended up, I sent a letter to Robert. I knew which prison he was in Oregon. I sent a letter to him and asked him if I could come and visit him. And within a week, he responded back to me and sent me a visitor application, which I filled out. And then eventually I was able to go into the prison with Robert and meet with him for an hour. The prison authorities had given me an opportunity to meet with him for 1 hour. It was on April 11th of 2011, I believe, that I went in there. And we had 1 hour from 1:30 to 2:30. And so I had some friends driving to the prison. That was the first time I had ever been in prison. At that point in my career, I'd probably put hundreds of people in prison for hundreds of years. But I'd never been in a prison before. And that the impact of going into a prison was so sobering to me. You know, the idea of walking through the bars, going through the doors and the bars closing behind me, and signing all sorts of waivers to go in and speak with Robert. But eventually, he and I met in the same conference room. There were two other people there with us. And I had no idea what I was going to talk about. My friends were asking me, what are you going to talk about with him? And I said, I have no idea. I'm just praying that God's going to prepare my heart and his heart for the time we have together. And so we began talking around. It was from 1:30 to 2:30, and began talking around at 1:30 when he came in. And I was just asking questions about his family and his background. We were not allowed to talk about the case because he was appealing the jury decision. And so I kind of looked up at the clock, and 5 or 10 minutes had gone by. So I asked some more questions. We talked a little bit. And finally, emotionally, physically, I was so exhausted, I just stopped. And I looked at the clock, and it was 1:45, and we still had 45 minutes to go. And so I looked at Robert, and I said, Robert, do you have any questions for me? At that point, you know, he bowed his head, and he said, I am so sorry. And I knew exactly what he was talking about. And then he looked at me, and he says, Judge, how can you be so kind to me? And at that point, I just felt Jesus is crashing into that conference room in that prison in Eastern Oregon, and the door just opened for me to talk to Robert about the gospel and the good news. And so I spent the next 45 minutes talking to him about Jesus Christ and forgiveness, and some of my favorite scriptures, Revelation 3:20, where Jesus is outside, and you know, he's knocking on the door, says, if you let me in, I'll come in and dine with you and you with me. And I told Robert that was Jesus's invitation to have a personal relationship with him. So in the end, I ended up praying for Robert, and the meeting ended at 2:30, and the guard walked Robert out of the conference room. It was interesting. When the guard came back about 10 minutes later, he said, Judge, he said, I've never seen Robert cry before. He had been there for about a year and a half at that point. Mm-hmm. Said, I've never seen Robert cry before. We had to stop in the hallway so he could gather himself before he went back into the general population. And then what the guard told me was really interesting. He says, you know, the words you were talking to Robert were with me because my son was killed 3 years ago. And so it just taught me that lesson that you never know who's going to be listening to you when you're sharing the good news of Jesus Christ with someone.
Yeah, even in an environment like that. Now, most of us would have washed our hands of this whole kind of heart and soul work, to walk away from the prison, to see justice done for the sake of your daughter, to resume your life serving in a community in Oregon. that would have been enough. But God was calling you into to deeper work as well. Because you had written the book, because of your role as a judge and your connection and contact with the person who murdered your daughter, you were invited to speak all around the country. And that resulted in a relationship, opportunity to meet someone in the prison system that really changed the course of your life.
Yeah, it changed my life dramatically. So what happened is when I finished speaking with Robert, I came back, I wrote the last chapter of my book. It sat around for a while, and then eventually it was published in November of 2012. Well, I thought I was writing the book for parents who had lost loved ones, children through tragic circumstances, or other people who've lost loved ones through tragic circumstances. And I was, but God also had another plan for that book. What that book did is it opened the door for me to go speak initially in prisons around the state of Oregon about Jesus Christ and forgiveness. And so I would go to prisons. I contacted the prisons initially. I'd go to them and I'd say, I'd just love to have an opportunity to speak to some of the men or one woman's prison here in Oregon and just tell them about hope and comfort and forgiveness. And so I think I was probably the only judge in the country that was putting people in prison and then going and ministering to them after I put them in prison. So I started traveling around prisons in Oregon, and then eventually I started getting some invites to come to prisons in other countries or other states. And so I started traveling to Texas and Louisiana and Georgia and North Carolina, some southern states, Washington. And then I went overseas, and I was able to speak in a couple of prisons in Rwanda and then a prison in Indonesia. So this book opened the door for me to just go and talk to people who were incarcerated around the world and around our country and give them, offer them hope, that the idea that Jesus Christ can forgive them, their victims can forgive them, just the hope that's found in Jesus Christ. And so eventually I ended up going to a prison in Louisiana called Angola Prison. Now, Angola used to be one of the bloodiest, most violent maximum security prisons in the United States. In 1 year, over 20 inmates were murdered at Angola. It sits on 18,000 acres. It has a main prison and six satellite prisons. It's the only prison in the country with its own zip code. Angola Prison has a TV, only prison in the country with its own TV station. They have their own radio station. They have a hospice program. They were one of the first prisons in the country to start a hospice program, which is now one of the best hospice programs in the country. They grow their own vegetables at Angola enough to feed themselves and four other prisons in Louisiana. They have a rodeo in the spring and in the fall, which generates $2.6 million a year for the industry. The free world is allowed to come in and watch the men do rodeo events. And so what happened, though, that's the way it is now. And what happened was in 1995, a warden by the name of Burl Kane, who's a believer, was assigned to Angola. That was one place he didn't want to go in Louisiana, that he got the assignment, so he was appointed the warden there. And what he did is he understood that morally responsible people do not commit crimes. They don't steal, they don't kill, they don't rape, they don't destroy. And so he invited the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary to come to Angola Prison and set up a four-year college degree program where they would be taught biblical principles in the courses that they were taking. And so he started that in 1995. In 1999, they had their first graduation class, and the culture of the prison began to change.
I'm going to stop you right there, but we'll continue our conversation in a moment. I need to take a quick break. Again, you're listening this afternoon to the Frank Sontag program. I'm Georgine Rice, sitting in for Frank for the, next couple of days. We'll be back in just a moment to continue my conversation with Senior Judge Tom Cole, founder and president of Paid in Full. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Georgine Rice, in for Frank Sontag. I'm the afternoon talk host at KKLA's sister station, KPDQ in Portland. Hey, you can give us a call at 888-528-2257, and let's talk. That's 888-528-2557. I'm continuing my conversation with Senior Judge Tom Cole. He's the founder and director of Paid in Full. He's also the author of Losing Megan. We're talking about how God called him into ministry as a result of the most tragic event of his life. Well, in the early 90s, Louisiana's Angola prison was considered the most violent and bloodiest maximum security prison in the country. But a Bible seminary program was implemented there. Inmate and staff assaults reduced 75%, and that's only part of the story. Now, just before the break, Judge, we were talking about the fact that you had the opportunity to visit there and witness what God has been doing. Tell us a bit about it.
Yeah, so I went down there in October of 2013 and spent 4 days on the Angola prison grounds. My wife went with me, too. And I can tell you, I never felt threatened. It was one of the safest places I had ever been in my life. My wife and I never heard a cuss word while we were there visiting the six facilities that were there at the site. And so anyway, I spoke with the men there on a couple of different occasions, and we came back, and the warden invited me to come back down again in 2014. So I went back down and did some more speaking, and I met some of the individuals and heard some of the amazing stories that those men had, the transformation of their hearts from, you know, being cold and hard-hearted to turning them into soft-hearted, hearts-of-flesh men, and the culture was just amazing in spite of the background that they had. 70% of the men in Angola prison were their lifers. So I was getting ready to come back one day, and I was in the warden's office, and he and I were talking, and I asked him if I could pray for him, and he said sure. And so I was getting ready to leave. I was going to be flying back to Portland the next morning, and the warden said, Judge, he said, sit down, bow your head, and close your eyes. And so when the warden of a maximum security prison tells you to sit down, bow your head, and close your eyes, you do, and I did, and this was his prayer. His prayer was this. He said, Dear Lord, don't let this man rest until they have a Bible college in the Oregon Department of Corrections. Amen. And I looked at the warden and I said, Warden, why would you want me to have no rest until that happens? That will never happen in Oregon. Oregon is one of the most unchurched states in the country. It will never happen. That's an impossible impossibility. And the warden just kind of looked at me and with his southern draw, and he says, Judge, he says, who do we worship? And at that point, I knew I'd been captured for that moment by God.
Absolutely.
God was speaking to me through Warden Kane. And so that put that on my heart to come back to Oregon to see what I could do to set up some type of program in Oregon. And so when I got back, the first person I called was Colette Peters, who was the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. And I asked her if we could have a coffee together, and she said, yep. So we met. And I told her about my trip to Angola and the change that had happened there at Angola. And of course, she knew about that, being in the system, and she knew of Warden Kane. And she knew the change that was going on there. And I asked her if she'd be willing to have a field trip, send somebody from her office to get on to Angola to see what it was like, to have an eyes-on field trip down there. And she said, sure. It was just so easy. And so I ended up talking with some legislators, some other people, the Attorney General heard I was taking some people down to Angola, and she contacted me and wanted to know if one of her people could go. And so in the end, we had 12 people, including me, going down to Angola prison in January of 2015. And I think most of the officials that were going down were thinking we were going to prison, and we were going to Angola prison. They didn't realize that we were also going to church. And what was happening was when we would speak with men, graduates from the seminary or other men in the prison, they would talk about, they'd give us examples, like when I was in New Orleans committing crimes and doing drugs, or when I was in Baton Rouge committing crimes and doing drugs, I was really in prison. And it wasn't until I was sentenced to Angola prison and came to the seminary that I became free. And so on the outside, they were in prison. On the inside, they were free. And this really was pretty amazing. The Oregon officials were pretty impressed with the people they were seeing and those type of words that they were hearing about the change, you know, in their hearts.
Well, it really is such a dramatic story of change. And I don't know if our listeners can fully appreciate how impossible what you were charged with doing is here in the state of Oregon. And yet you seem to have God's favor, and he opened doors that under any other circumstance would simply not be available to you. Fast forward, and the thing that you were charged with in that prayer, that you would not rest until there was a similar program in the Oregon prison system, is now a reality. Can you believe, first of all, the journey that you've been on and how God has provided at every turn what was needed in order for this this dream, if you will, to come true?
Yeah, you know, looking back on it, I mean, it was totally God. It was he was working through the ministry that we founded here. And he was just opening doors up all over the place. So I retired in January of 2016, and I'm a senior judge now here in Oregon. I still have some judging obligations to the Oregon Judicial Department. And but anyway, on my retirement vacation in the spring of 2016, I received an email from a friend of mine in the Oregon Department of Corrections who said, "Hey, Judge, they're willing to consider allowing you to bring a four-year college degree program, faith-based college degree program, in one of their prisons." And I couldn't get back to the States quick enough, when I got that email from my friend. So I came back and started meeting with some prison officials. We started working on a memorandum of understanding. I formed the nonprofit that I run now. It's called Paid in Full Oregon. It's paidinfulloregon.org. You can go to the website and you can learn a lot about what we're doing here with that. So I did that, and then I started meeting with several different college presidents around the state to see what their interest would be in setting up a fully accredited extension in one of our prisons. And so I eventually got some encouragement from Sheldon Nord, who's the president of Corbin University at C-O-R-B-A-N, Corbin University in Salem. So he and I met several times. He registered with Christian universities and probably other universities too. He said they could afford to do it on their own. And I felt God was telling me that I could promise him that Paid in Full Oregon would pay for all their costs associated with implementing or implanting their college extension program in one of Oregon's prisons.
Which was quite a statement of faith at the time.
Yeah, so we entered into a funding agreement. Paid in Full entered into a funding agreement with Corbin University to reimburse them for all of their expenses associated with implanting their college degree program. Then I also entered into a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Corrections. I talked about what our responsibilities were, and the Department of Corrections designated a space in one of their correctional institutions, OSCI. So we were 3,300 square feet space in that to house the education program.
Absolutely incredible. Now, we're going to take a break here in just a moment, but when we come back, I'd like to talk about how current circumstances have impacted this effort. You began just a short time ago, and COVID-19, the pandemic, has, of course, changed things for virtually everyone. We'll find out what the status is of this project and how listeners can learn more about it. Again, we're talking this afternoon with Senior Judge Tom Cole. He is the founder and director of Paid in Full. He's also the author of Losing Megan. It's a really quite a read to consider how God gives the capacity for forgiveness. And in this day and time when hatred has been elevated to something of a virtue, when you single out different groups for not what they've done necessarily, for what they think, we would do well to learn something about what the scriptures have to say on the subject. We'll continue our conversation with Judge Cole in just a few moments. Again, you're listening to the Frank Sontag program. I'm Georgine Rice filling in. I'm the host of a KPDQ station, a Salem affiliate in the Portland metro area. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Georgine Rice in for Frank Sontag. I'm the afternoon talk host at KKLA's sister station, KPDQ, in Portland, Oregon. You can give us a call at 888-528-2557 if you'd like to weigh in. Let us know what's on your mind. 888-528-2557. I'm continuing my conversation with Senior Judge Tom Cole, the founder and director of Paid in Full. Their vision is to change the culture of the Oregon prison system by transforming adults in custody into spiritual and moral leaders. They provide accredited bachelor's degree, spiritual moral leadership, impact the person and population throughout the state in a rather significant and unique program, certainly for the state of Oregon. Now, just before the break, we were talking about how the program is working in the state. Talk a little bit about the status at this point and how or if the pandemic has impacted the progress in these early days of the program.
Yeah, thanks, Georgine. So we ended up having to remodel the classroom space, and the cost of that went beyond our wildest imagination. It ended up costing $684,500. We gave three separate checks to the Department of Corrections to do that remodel. And so it took about 3 months to do. Remodeling inside a prison is expensive. It's specialized. And so the remodel started last October. And our classes also started last October. So we opened up the college to all the inmates in the Oregon prison system. We decided to limit our cohorts to 25 each. And so we had our first cohort come last fall. They actually put them in a temporary classroom. They came from several prisons throughout the state of Oregon. And they began their studies there. And so then earlier this year, we had to shut down because of the COVID. However, we were still allowed, our professors were actually going in. So these professors go in, Corbin University, they teach live. They teach face-to-face, which I believe is one of the most effective ways to teach. This mm-hmm. is not an online college program. So professors were allowed to send in education packets, they called them. And the men were able to do their work. They got their homework assignments. They did their homework, gave it back to professors. And so we ended up successfully completing the first semester of the program. We're now in the second semester of the program for our first cohort class, and they're doing those educational packets again. We believe the professors may be able to come back for the first cohort in the latter part of August, the early part of September, but things obviously change on a daily basis with COVID going on.
So well, that we are gives also us some insight on how to pray.
Yes. And we're also in the process now of selecting our second cohort. And the deadline was a few days ago. I don't know how many people applied. Last year, almost 300 men from the Oregon prison system applied for the college. So we'll go through that application procedure with these men. Ultimately, Corbin University will determine the 25 who come in.
Now, one of the things that I mentioned as part of your vision is that you want to transform adults in custody into spiritual and moral leaders. This isn't just a figure of speech. You just don't want them to be academically and spiritually trained. You want to provide for them opportunities to minister to their fellow adults in custody.
Yeah, this is the really interesting part of this, because the culture of the prison is going to change from the inside out through these graduates. Now, they're going to get their degree in 4 years. It will be what they call a Bachelor of Science, specializing in psychology, social services, and leadership. These men, and indeed the DOC is in agreement with this, these men will, after they graduate, will be sent out to other prisons in the Oregon system to be to provide peer mentor services to other inmates. They're going to be helping with suicide watch. They will help with cell-to-cell encouragement. They're going to help gang renunciation. They're going to help in the hospice programs. They're going to be mental health helpers, and they're going to be education tutors. And so the DOC is really excited about these graduates who will get this transformative education and send them out throughout the Oregon prison system. So that's the plan. Our first graduates aren't going to be graduating until 2023, God willing. And so those men will then be sent out. I call them missionaries. Mm-hmm. The DOC doesn't use that term, but I call them missionaries throughout the Oregon prison system, which will impact the culture. Now, this has been proven across the country. There are 17 other states that are doing this now. And the cultures have changed from the inside out. This is not a reentry program. Eventually, it's going to be a reentry program because in Oregon, 95% of the people who are in prison are going to be returned back to our communities. And so the question becomes, how do we want them to come back with a hardened heart in a 40-foot waistband or with transformed hearts and a college degree or maybe even a Bible in their hand? I mean, the question is really easy to answer. Mm-hmm. So not only is this program giving the men hope within the prison and their fellow inmates, it's also giving their families hope on the outside because the family can say, my dad, my uncle, my husband, well, he's serving his time in prison, but he's also getting a four-year college degree program there, and he's agreed to go out and help the other inmates. Now, one of the requirements for our program is the men applicants have to have at least 8 years left on their sentence. So we want them to get their degree in 4 years, and then we want to have at least 4 years that they can give back, you know, for getting their degree. I think over half of the men in our first cohort have life sentences. They're not going to ever get out. So this is really where we get a good bang for our dollar. From the perspective, these men are going to be ministering in prison for the rest of their earthly lives. And this is an opportunity for these men to turn their pain into purpose, you know, and only God can do that, you know, working through them. And so that's the hope of this program down the road, that these men are going to have just a tremendous impact on the population of the prison within the prison system itself.
Hmm. I love this version of God's redemptive story being played out in the least likely place, and that is in a prison where people are incarcerated for many, many years in many cases. Now, I want to talk a little bit about you. And before I do that, I should mention for listeners who would like to explore more, you can go to paidinfulloregon.org. And there's a great deal of information there, paidinoregon.org. Now, can they also find your book there?
Oh, yeah, it's there too.
Okay.
The book is there. It's on Amazon too. There's a very good.
Now, I just wanted to talk a little bit about how God called you into this ministry. You've served faithfully as an attorney. You've served in the state of Oregon as a judge. You became a follower of Christ and have faithfully served him. And you probably had a vision of what your future and potential retirement would look like. And yet God had a plan that was quite different than you could have imagined. Now, the fact that you're in the criminal justice system and that you had a daughter who was murdered and directly impacted by that system, when the person who was responsible for her death, you come face to face with him, you have an opportunity to encounter him. Can you just speak to the listener who might be despairing, wondering whether or not God has any plan or purpose for their life, or perhaps they have heard from God a direction that runs counter to what they imagined or even imagined possible?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, George, and thanks for asking that. You know, if you look at the circumstances that you're in now, whatever circumstances you may be, it's hard to see a lot of times where God wants you to end up. And I had no clue that this is where God wanted me to end up. With such a devastating loss like that, I had no place to turn but to God. And it was every day getting up and saying, God, what do you want me to do today? You know, how do you want me? Where do you want me to go? What do you want me to say? And, I've made a lot of mistakes over that time period, too. And sometimes I don't hear God right on that. and it's pretty obvious, you know, when something comes out of my mouth, but it's not godly. But you know, it's just one of those things where God is so faithful, He will honor you when you're listening to Him, when your heart is listening to Him. He will honor you. He will never give you anything that you can't handle. He gives us things we can't handle a lot of times. That's so we turn to Him. But He will always provide a means for you to get the job done. And so I've always been able to follow orders. I was born in a town in Ohio called Defiance. Sometimes Defiance, and sometimes that has been part of my personality. And I get spanked every once in a while by God. But and I'm not a smart person. I was very fortunate to become a judge. I struggled in law school. I eventually ended up graduating in the top 10% of the lower half of my law school class. So you don't have to be brainy to do stuff like this. It's just having that desire to please God. He will reward you. And even if it doesn't seem like you're being rewarded now, I mean, ultimately, we know as believers, our reward is going to be eternity with Him, right? So.
Yeah. Well, Judge Tom Cole, I thank you so much for the work that you're doing in our home state of Oregon and across the country. And I thank you for taking the time to join us here today.
So this is a spoiler alert for Californians. I'll be coming down to California to be meeting with some people from a Christian college down there to talk about doing the same thing in California that we're doing here in Oregon. So
keep your ears to the ground. There'll be opportunity for you as well. Hey, thank you, Judge Tom. God bless.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Again, you can go to paidinfulloregon.org for more information, and that might give you a clue of what to anticipate in California.
Thanks for listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at @GRiceShow and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.